Hi, my name is Colleen Grogan, and I'm a professor at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration, which we commonly refer to as SSA. It is my pleasure to talk today with Tina Sachs, assistant professor at the University of Berkeley School of Social Welfare, about her book, Invisible Visits, Black Middle-Class Women in the American Healthcare System. Tina received her doctorate from SSA, and her fields of interest include racial inequities in health, social determinants of health, and poverty and inequality. In fact, SSA is currently celebrating the centennial of our doctoral program, so your timing is perfect. Welcome back to SSA, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So you conducted the interviews for which your book is based on in 2011. And in some ways, a lot has changed since then. Donald Trump was elected president in 2016. We now have the first female Black gay mayor of Chicago. The Me Too and Black Lives Matters movement took off, and many proclaim to be woke today, quote unquote woke. And yet many of the same racial problems that have existed for centuries in the U.S. still persist. These are big macro changes, which sometimes filter down and make a difference in people's lives, but sometimes not. So I'm wondering, what do you think? If you conducted the interviews today, 9 years later, do you think your findings would be different?
Mm-hmm. Great questions. I think I would like to be optimistic that they may be different, but I'm not particularly convinced that they would be for a couple of reasons. One, I think the American healthcare system is a big institution. It doesn't change that quickly, and neither do kind of big social problems that we have, particularly sexism, racism, and other forms of discrimination, that although societies move forward in some respects, I think these are durable problems that I wouldn't necessarily expect to change in the present.
Yeah. I want to get to that in the end, kind of thinking about how we might change mm-hmm. things. But maybe we could just get into some of the findings mm-hmm. in your book. Mm-hmm. In chapter two, you detail the stereotyping of Black women's experience when they encounter the healthcare system, how they pursue all sorts of self-presentation styles to convince providers of their knowledge and kind of quote, good behavior, unquote, in an attempt to overcome these stereotypes. And of course, you detail the mental toll this can exact on Black women. I'm wondering if you can discuss these trends and how they intersect with the new trends in the healthcare system around patient-centered medicine. Mm-hmm. You reference this in the book, but maybe you can expand on that a bit. So patient-centered medicine expects people to advocate for themselves, kind of shifting the burden from the physician to the patient. Mm-hmm. So how do some of these stereotypes and self-presentation styles mm-hmm. play out in that kind of new reform?
Mm-hmm. So I think everyone is under pressure. So, and when I say everyone, I mean everyone, regardless of, you know, of gender, of race, of age, et cetera. I think everyone is under pressure in this kind of a healthcare environment to go to the doctor with very succinct understanding of their own problems, of their chief complaint, of being able to rationally describe what their concerns are. And I do think that's a function of a very rushed system in which physicians have very little time and really want to sort of get people in and out because of the market pressures that they're under. I think that it is compounded for people who are not taken as seriously in the world in general. So women are not taken as seriously, or sort of their complaints are not necessarily taken as seriously. And Black women in particular face a whole host of stigmatizing and delegitimizing perspectives, stereotypes about them, so that when they go to the healthcare encounter and are also, they butt up against this patient-centered responsibility that shifts the responsibility of acting in a certain way in the healthcare encounter. And it's compounded by the fact that they often walk in with less credibility than other people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you have this great quote from James Baldwin at the end of the book, and I'll just read it here. Quote, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's faced," end quote. As you know very well, our healthcare system suffers from many problems, many of which you just mentioned, extremely high cost of care, fragmentation, lack of coordination, unequal access. So given these larger systemic issues, if we did face racial discrimination in the healthcare system, kind of back to Baldwin's quote, mm-hmm. What could be changed?
I mean, I think if we took, I'm thinking about the sort of coming from a Black feminist perspective, which suggests that if Black women could be free, everyone would be free because of sort of the intersections of these kinds of forms of discrimination. I think it's very difficult to talk about health inequity without talking about this bigger context of the fragmentation of the healthcare system more generally, because everyone faces the incredible challenges getting in and being treated with dignity and respect because it's so hard to navigate the cost, the barriers to care, et cetera. So I think providing really addressing perhaps, you know, actually doing universal, coming up with a universal care plan, universal coverage plan, like Medicare for All, would provide a universal intervention, but then we would still need some targeted intervention to deal with the particular issues of race and other forms of discrimination in healthcare.
Mm. So, I mean, you also point out in the conclusion that treatment discrimination is not exclusive to the medical establishment or the healthcare system, but obviously part and parcel mm-hmm. of our broader mm-hmm. society. Mm-hmm. So what does this imply about our efforts to address the social determinants of health? Because, you know, Medicare for All, we could create universal health insurance, but we still know that there are all these other mm-hmm. barriers. Mm-hmm.
I think one thing that would be a huge intervention in the United States is if we actually provided the resources to deal with social determinants of health. What I mean by that is in other countries, in industrialized Western countries, in Europe, for example, they provide housing subsidies, perhaps income floors, educational subsidies, childcare subsidies, all kinds of other social resources that actually can improve people's health at the population level. So if we wanted to really do something about health overall, I think those are the kinds of inputs that we would need to focus on, not only providing universal health care, but actually dealing with people's basic needs like food and housing.
Right, right. And of course, there's so much racial discrimination in the housing markets.
Right.
So you do, there is a sense that we have to deal with racial discrimination across the board.
Right.
Perhaps, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So shifting a little bit, mm-hmm. What are you working on now?
Uh-huh.
And yeah, what should we be thinking about in terms of race and class and mm-hmm. gender?
So I'm working on a study right now with a colleague at Washington University in St. Louis. We haven't actually begun all the data collection yet, but we're trying to understand the cost of upward social mobility among Black people. So we're going to be doing a study here in Chicago and in San Francisco, doing interviews, focus groups, as well as trying to develop some measures to try to understand what the toll of trying to reach and stay in the middle class, what kinds of health tolls and psychological tolls does that take? Mm-hmm. So trying to understand for people who may have been lower income as a child, but then have now gotten a college degree and have a middle class income, how hard is it to get there and how hard is it to stay there and at what cost to the person's individual health and the mm. health of the community mm. more broadly. So that's kind of what we're thinking about now, and also thinking about how that varies by gender. So one of the preliminary studies we did, we compared Black women and Black men who were middle class, and found that Black women really bore a disproportional burden of sharing their resources across their entire family, the extended family. Whereas whereas Black men tended to think about their responsibility to the community as more about information or about sort of being a role model, whereas Black women really were doing tutoring for their, for their nephew, providing money for their great aunt to go to wherever she needed to go. So the resources were stretched quite far, and the women felt the responsibility to do that.
And so you think it makes it more difficult for Black middle-class women to kind of maintain that class position than male Black middle or Black middle
potentially
class
men. Right, yeah. Right, or that there's more of a strain on the on women, and there was also a relational strain, so that if women said no to people who in their extended family network or friend network, if they needed some kind of, if they needed money and the woman would say no, that there were repercussions for saying no, that there were ruptures in relationships as a result.
That's really interesting. And is there a health component in that study? Are you thinking about how that that kind of positionality and the sort of being able to maintain your place in a particular class position is related to health?
So we're thinking about it as in terms of psychological well-being more generally, and then and physical stress. So we did ask people about whether the stress affected their ability to exercise, to sleep, to eat well. Certain kinds of behavioral challenges that they may have had as a result of the financial strain or uplift strain that they experienced. So it's a little more distal, but we are asking about that.
Right. And we know that mental health impacts the physical. So that's definitely related. So finally, looking back on your time here, kind of back to SSA's centennial year for the SSA's doctoral program. I wonder if you could think back on your time here, and what would you say you gained the most from SSA's doctoral program?
Oh, I mean, I have to say, SSA's doctoral program was incredibly rigorous. It was incredibly challenging, and the thing that it taught me the most, I think, was how to evaluate evidence, to think critically about the social world, and to be able to pose questions that are a little bit outside of the box, perhaps, for social workers or for social scientists, and to be comfortable with that, and to really approach that from a place of curiosity and also rigor. And so I think that also directly relates to having you as my mentor here, that you really facilitated that for me.
Well, thank you. So Tina, thank you so much for your time and sharing your expertise with us. I hope that you will return to SSA soon. I'm so glad that we've had this chance to spend together talking, and I really look forward to hearing your talk this evening as well. Hopefully that will also be recorded and people can have a chance to check that out as well. Thank you to everyone for listening. To learn more about SSA and the important work we do to produce the best, most forward-thinking research in social work and social welfare policy, and to prepare the best social workers to use those ideas to serve individuals, families, and communities in creating a better quality of life, please visit ssa.uchicago.edu.